The next case that we have is Grace McGuire with Mr. Ace. Good morning, sir. And Mr. Jones. Mr. Ace, would you like to reserve some time for rebuttals?
I'd like to reserve 4 minutes, if I may.
4 minutes, sure. And we're happy to hear from you.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Alexander Maxwell Ace. I represent the appellant in this matter, Ms. Grace Nadine McGuire. We're asking this court to reaffirm its holding in Bonner and to reject the discredited theory of venue relied upon in the circuit court. In Bonner, this court said that the argument that venue lies wherever some evil traceable to the crime occurs would result in the complete frustration of the general venue statute. And I contrast this with the reasoning that was relied upon by the circuit court judge in this case, where he said venue is appropriate in the place where the harm was done, as well as where the call was made, so it doesn't matter where the call was made. This maybe makes intuitive sense, but it's contrary to the statute. It's contrary to the law of the Commonwealth.
Contrary to the statute, we're talking about 18.2461?
Yes.
Okay, how is it contrary to the statute? Do you think that the statute's ambiguous?
I don't think that the statute's ambiguous. I think it's quite clear. It criminalizes giving a false report.
Okay, and doesn't someone have to receive that false report in order to commit the crime that the statute is talking about?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, and the reason why I don't believe so is because other statutes make a very clear distinction between giving and receiving. And so, for example, in 18.2-374.1:1, that criminalizes the giving away of child pornography. And the statute goes on to specifically provide for venue in the location where it was received. And so there is this distinction that the legislature is drawing between the act of giving and the fact of receiving. And in some crimes, you are liable for venue wherever either of those things occur. That's not this statute.
Why is that not the statute? Why is the information that you're talking about, how can it not be in this statute? Tell me why, aside from the case that you cite. Can you distinguish? I mean, isn't that the basis for venue that either in the place, for instance, in this case, could an argument be made? And I think that certainly the Commonwealth makes that argument that venue could lie either in the place where the call was received by the police officer or in the place in which the call was made.
If there was a specific venue provision that said venue could lie where the call was received, as the legislature has done for other offenses, then I believe that that would be the case. But here, the statute only criminalizes giving a false report. That's committed when and where the giving is done, without reference to where the receiving is done. The commission of the offense, the actus reus of a crime, is what the criminal defendant does. And under this statute, 461, it's giving.
But to follow up on Judge Chaffin's question, if we were to adopt your interpretation, if someone across the line in West Virginia or someone across the line in Maryland decided they wanted to create all kinds of false reports to prevent the Loudoun police from focusing on something else that was going on, perhaps, mm-hmm. and they reported it from just across the line in Maryland or across the line in West Virginia, they couldn't ever be prosecuted, could they?
I don't think that's accurate, Your Honor, and I believe it's not accurate because the legislature considered that when they're crafting these venue statutes, and they specifically addressed that situation. If someone commits a crime wholly outside of the Commonwealth and it has an effect here in the Commonwealth, they can be prosecuted anywhere. That's 19.2-245. And so that contingency has been addressed. And furthermore, 244 subsection B says that if it cannot be readily determined where the crime was committed, then there are ways that we can still prosecute this person. You can prosecute them where the defendant resides or where they're apprehended or, where some harm does occur. And so had the Commonwealth shown that we can't determine where this offense was committed, then they could have resorted to 244B, and maybe they could have established venue under that provision. Instead, the Commonwealth and the trial court relied on this faulty theory that wherever the harm is, that's where venue is appropriate.
But if you read 19.2-244 with the statute we were just talking about, that we're really the one we're dealing with here, the 18.2-461.
Yes.
If you read them together, and we are supposed to read statutes so that they harmonize with each other, if the purpose is to prevent police from being sent on a wild goose chase, resources to deal with other crime are then reduced, why wouldn't it also be where the harm occurred or where the report was received that diverted police from where perhaps they needed to be addressing crime?
Frankly, Your Honor, I believe that that's what the statute should say. It's not what it says.
Can't you read the two of them together like that?
They're
supposed to harmonize, right?
They're supposed to harmonize, but we're supposed to harmonize the code section, and that's why I like to talk about these other criminal statutes where this concern, the legislature addressed it head on. So 18.2-212B criminalizes the false summoning of emergency medical services. And that section provides either where the summons was made from or the jurisdiction that received the summons. And so I think that's a very similar situation where you're talking about diverting resources. It should be prosecutable where the diversion and where the false report was received. And had the legislature put that into this statute and said whoever gives the false report has committed a crime and they can be prosecuted wherever those false reports are received, we have no case. But I think we have to respect these other distinctions in the statutes, because otherwise we're not giving effect to specific pronouncements of the legislature. If this theory is right, that wherever the harm occurs, wherever the report is received, even though the statute doesn't say it, we can have venue there, then it nullifies this section of 212B. It nullifies 37.4.1:1, where they went on to say that you can prosecute where the child pornography, in that case, where it's received. And so we have to give effect to all of the pronouncements of the legislature. We have to read the statutes in harmony and avoid adopting a rule of interpretation that's going to cause specific provisions to become meaningless. We also can't read in what's not there. And so in light of the fact that the legislature does specifically address these exact kinds of circumstances where a crime can be committed at a distance and where the harm can be inflicted apart from where the commission of the offense occurred, the fact that they didn't do it here, I think, needs to be respected. It needs to be taken seriously.
What about the Supreme Court's decision in, I think it was 2011, in Kelso, that says that where the direct and immediate result of an illegal act occurred?
So the key issue in Kelso is the fact, and this is a, I think this is a quote from that case, the crime consists of more than one act. That crime presupposed that the defendant will cause someone else to do something. That other something has to happen. And what Kelso is based on is the concept that the first act could be in one jurisdiction, the other act could be in another, but you need acts. And I think that's really the principle of Kelso, is that criminal venue is founded upon the commission of prescribed acts. And so holding that in mind, the Supreme Court looked at the statute and said, this statute acknowledges multiple acts that have to occur. They occur in different jurisdictions. The crime can be prosecuted in any one of those jurisdictions. This case has one act, giving. Where that occurs, that's where the crime was committed, and that's where venue should be.
Well, counsel, I understand your argument fully, but how is giving, for instance, if someone sits, according to your argument, if I said there's someone abusing a child somewhere that I don't even know that person, don't even know any of those things, and I made that hypothetical or made that statement, and it didn't get to the ears of anyone, of a police officer or human services, a Department of Human Services officer, anyone that was authorized to go check on that. And it was, in fact, false. But if it didn't get to them, how is that a crime? I mean, no one knows about it. It has to be received, and that's where your argument, that's, explain to me why it doesn't have to be received, I guess, is the bottom line.
I believe that if it was intended to reach law enforcement, then you would have an attempted commission of the offense, and someone could be prosecuted under that. I tend to agree with you that there's this weird way of looking at the difference between giving and receiving. How can you have a giver without a receiver? That's really not for us to work out, because that distinction between giving and receiving is understood, acknowledged, implemented by the legislature throughout the code section. They know that there is a distinction between giving and receiving. We know that they know that because they distinguish between it, and here they chose not to. And so we can only look at the one half of the one side of the coin, maybe, the giving. And where that is, that's where the crime, that's where the offense was committed. And the receipt could be in another jurisdiction. In other statutes, they allow for prosecution in those other jurisdictions. Under this statute, they don't. I'd like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal, if I may.
Sure.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is John Jones for the Commonwealth, and we're asking the court to affirm the judgment in Loudoun County Circuit Court because venue was proper in Loudoun County for this case. So first, I think that the result in this case is controlled by Kelso. Under Kelso, venue is proper, and there's a direct quote, in the jurisdiction where the direct and immediate result of an illegal act occurred, even if the illegal act occurred in another jurisdiction. I don't think that there's any way for McGuire to distinguish from that principle of law that's laid down in Kelso. Obviously, in Kelso, you had a slightly different kind of crime where it consisted of the criminal agent causing another person to commit another crime in their service, whereas here, the criminal act is just the giving of the false report, and I'll get in a minute to the relationship between giving and receiving as it relates to venue here. But that doesn't distinguish this statute from the principle in Kelso, that central principle. And here, I mean, I think it's important to note that the only harm, the only direct and immediate result occurred in Loudoun County. And more broadly, with respect to this statute, I think that it was enacted to prevent both the waste of resources and the danger of police responding and having their resources diverted from real emergencies. The only harm here occurred in Loudoun County. So venue is certainly proper here, where the direct and immediate result of that false report is in Loudoun County. There's this sort of attempted distinction between facts and acts in service of this attempt to distinguish Kelso that's raised in McGuire's reply brief, but I don't think that is really, is a distinction without a difference between facts and acts. What's important in both cases, both Kelso and the case at bar, is that criminal acts committed in one or an unknown jurisdiction projected a direct and immediate result into a receiving jurisdiction. So in Kelso, it was Kelso sitting in Henrico, acting entirely in Henrico, to send marijuana, a marijuana-toting juvenile, for just simplicity's sake, into Hanover. And in the same way, here we have McGuire acting in an unknown jurisdiction to send a false report into Loudoun. So in both cases, where the direct and immediate result of the illegal act occurred, venue is proper there. And if I could speak to the relationship and how to read Kelso and Bonner together, I think that that's important, because in Bonner you have a case where, you know, Kelso is distinguished and where the the harms resulting from the defacing of the firearm are not direct and immediate enough, I think, to tie to any jurisdiction where the gun may be brought thereafter. So you have remote and speculative harms that, sure, they result from the criminal act of defacing the firearm, but they're not the direct and immediate result. And so that's why that crime venue is only proper where the defacing of the firearm occurs. But here, while you have an act that may be discreet in time if you're dealing with a real-time communication, it's occurring in two places simultaneously, and I guess this is a good place to talk about. So giving and receiving, the fact that giving and receiving have different definitions, I guess dictionary definitions, that doesn't mean that one is not necessary to the other. And the court's already sort of raised this. Can you really say that the report's been given if it was never received? I don't think that you can be, and it's certainly not criminalized. There's a number of factual scenarios where someone might attempt to give a false report but fail to do so, and that certainly would not be criminalized, and venue would not be proper where they were trying to send the criminal communication to. And some of the factual scenarios where that might occur is if the person attempted to call emergency personnel but got the wrong number, if a civilian picked up the phone in the police station, if they left a voicemail or an email that was never read or listened to or got deleted by the officer, then in all of those situations, the crime would not be finished. So receiving that false report is necessary to conviction under this statute, and I think that's important.
Well, if there was a attempted making a false police report, and say for your example of calling 911 but calling the wrong number, are you saying that the venue would then be in the area in the jurisdiction where the person made the call, or are you saying that
I hadn't worked it out that far, Your Honor. I don't think that I don't know that you would have a criminal act. I didn't look up to see if there were instances of attempted false report to a law enforcement officer.
This is a question of statutory interpretation. And your colleague raises an interesting point about the fact that there are a number of statutes which provide for venue to be had either at one place or another place or something. This statute does not. Is that omission significant in this statute?
First, Your Honor, and I raise this in my brief, but I don't think that the court needs to get to the canons of construction, okay, and to read this in peri materia with the other unrelated. I mean, they're conceptually related, but they're certainly not related to this prosecution. So I do not think, my authority for that we don't get to the canons is in, I think, Kirby. Oh, no, Saunders and Kreger and a host of other statutes. I think that's a pretty well-established principle that, it's not just on my say-so that you don't need to look at in peri materia, but, where you don't have an ambiguity to resolve, then you don't need to resort to the canons. But more, I guess, to the point, I think that those same statutes existed when Kelso was decided. Those same statutes existed when Spiker was decided, and neither of those statutes had a specific venue provision for where it was sent or received. And yet, under the general venue statute, venue was proper in the receiving jurisdiction. I mentioned Spiker. I think that's another persuasive case. It's certainly not, I don't think, controlling here, but you have a criminal communication, and venue for that is proper either where it is sent from or where it is received. I think that McGuire is correct in the reply brief where you have a specific definition that's embedded in that statute for the kind of communication that is prescribed by it, that you have to make direct or personal contact. But I think that even using the plain language definition of giving a report, that that doesn't distinguish from that specific definition in 18.2-374.3. You wind up with the same result, I think, that contact has to be made, that it has to be both sent and received for the offense to be completed. And so I do think that the logic in Spiker is important, and it's essentially applying the same logic in Kelso, that both where the act is committed and where the direct and immediate result, and I know I sound like a broken record saying that, but that's important language to our case here.
And it doesn't matter that, as your opponent colleague said, that in Kelso and Spiker too, you have acts in the plural, whereas here you have the one act.
No, Your Honor, because while, and again, I think that it goes to the fact that while McGuire's making one act in sending the communication, it also has to be received for that giving to be completed. And again, I mean, I think that a contrary holding that to say that just merely sending a message off into the ether and it's never received, that exposes someone to criminal liability under this statute, that's problematic. That's very vague and removes an important component of the harms that the statute is intended to prevent. So I think that the Commonwealth's interpretation is not, but the reading of how the case law applies to the statutes at issue here is superior in that respect as well. And construing giving as requiring receipt is not a novel concept. I kind of was plumbing back into my law school first year property class and thinking about how giving property in that context requires an intent to give, an actual transfer, and acceptance. And here, that's not dispositive, but it's not like that we're reading something into this concept of giving that isn't natural to the idea of giving, that it both has to be intended to be sent, actually sent, and then received on the other end. I think in this context would be the right way to read and define giving in this false report context. And again, Bonner was distinguished from Kelso essentially because the receiving jurisdiction's harms from a defaced serial number were remote and speculative rather than direct and immediate. And that's in stark contrast to what we have here. Again, the only harm is occurring in Loudoun County here, regardless of where McGuire is calling from. On the absurd results, and this came up during McGuire's argument as well, the suggestion that Code Section 19.2-244, or 245 rather, is a remedy for out-of-state callers with respect to this. That statute is triggered by the defendant either being found in a Virginia jurisdiction or sent to a Virginia jurisdiction by any judge or court. And so it's really not clear how that would occur in the context of Judge Beal's your hypothetical, where they're across the border calling Loudoun, making all these false reports for whatever reason. And if they never enter Virginia and a judge never sends them to Virginia, and I'm not sure why they would from out of state, then they would escape. But the key is, and this is where the error is that 245 is for, it applies to statutes that are committed, or I'm sorry, crimes that are committed wholly outside of Virginia but made punishable within Virginia. Here we have a crime that's not committed wholly without Virginia, or without the Commonwealth. Whenever you are sending or giving a false report to a law enforcement officer that's located in the Commonwealth, you're committing that act in the Commonwealth. You're projecting your acts into the Commonwealth and creating a harm in the Commonwealth. So I don't think that 19.2-245 is really applicable to this statute and the hypothetical that Judge Beals raised. And another issue that occurred to me after briefing had concluded, but it's probably a more serious absurd result. If a report was made via email or voice over internet protocol, using a virtual private network or any other method of obscuring IP numbers. Under McGuire's interpretation of venue here, you would never be able to prove venue. So if the individual used the internet to send the report and was able to obscure their IP address, and there are a number of ways that can be done very simply to people with the right technical savvy, then venue would be impossible to prove, and certainly that's not what the General Assembly intended in enacting its venue statute and in the way that it should be rendered by this court. So if there are any other questions from the panel, I'd be happy to answer them. But beyond that, I would just urge and ask the court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You have some rebuttal time, sir. Come on up.
Thank you.
Sure.
I'd like to address the last point first, if I may.
Sure.
That's a situation where it could not be readily determined where the offense was committed. And that is the triggering language in 244B. If it cannot be readily determined, this is where venue could be. And so if you have a situation where someone's obscuring their location or the information is just not there, the prosecutors could raise a strong presumption that it cannot be readily determined, and then they would be able to take advantage of these alternative venue provisions. I don't agree that the principle in Kelso is necessarily that it's where the direct and immediate result occurred, and I think that there is an important distinction between Ms. McGuire's situation and the situation in Kelso, where Ms. McGuire has a false report that's potentially entering another jurisdiction, whereas Kelso has a gun or a drug-toting juvenile who's crossing jurisdictional boundaries and committing further acts, committing offenses in these other jurisdictions. I think that's what Kelso stands for, is that venue is founded on the commission of offenses, and it's what the defendant does that generates criminal liability. It's where they do it that founds venue under the general venue provisions. Bonner, I don't believe, is distinguished on the basis of the severity of the harm. It's distinguished on the basis of continuing offenses. And that's really what Bonner talks about a lot, is what kinds of offenses can travel across jurisdictional boundaries. And what Bonner stands for is that when you remove the serial number on a firearm, that's done when you're done. And even if you carry the gun across jurisdictions, it's not going to extend venue with it because it's not a continuing offense. Ms. McGuire's offense is neither a continuing offense. It's a single discrete act, giving a report. There's this issue about receiving, but the legislature has kind of put us in this position where we have to decide either this statute's kind of weird and it only allows for venue where the giving occurs without recognition of receipt, or we adopt the alternative position, and that makes a lot of other statutes also weird, where the legislature did this unnecessary work and these enactments are meaningless and of no purpose. And so between those two kind of weird interpretations, I believe that we should adopt the one that minimizes the harm to the statutory regime, gives respect to the pronouncements of the legislature, and gives meaning to these other statutory provisions. On Spiker, the prescribed activity in that statute is using a communication system. And the court relied on a specific statutory definition that says using a communication system means making personal or direct contact. And that's how they were able to achieve this view of the offense that allows for multi-jurisdictionality, that allows for venue either where you use a communication system or where personal and direct contact is made. We don't have anything like that here. We have giving the report. Wherever Ms. McGuire was when she gave the report, that's where the offense was committed. This statute is subject to the general venue provisions, which require prosecution where an offense is committed. And that was not established in any way in this case. So we ask that you set aside the conviction and remand.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ash. We'll come down and join great counsel.